I hadn't yet explained to him that if I see therapy patients outside the office, in order to protect their privacy, I won't acknowledge them if they don't acknowledge me first. It could be upsetting, for instance, if I said hello to a patient and the person accompanying her asked, "Who's that?" leaving the patient in the awkward position of having to hedge or explain on the spot. What if I were to say hello to a patient who was with a coworker or boss, or who was on a first date? Even if patients said hello to me first, I didn't introduce them to whomever I was with. That would also be breaking confidentiality, unless I were to lie when asked about how I knew the patient. So boyfriend was looking at me, and Luke was looking at boyfriend, and Keisha glanced at my hand, which boyfriend was holding. Unbeknownst to boyfriend, I'd already run into a patient while he and I were together. A few days before, the husband in a couple I was seeing walked by us on the street. Without stopping, he said hi. I said hi back, and we both kept going in opposite directions. "Who was that?" boyfriend had asked then. "Oh, just somebody I know through work," I said casually. Never mind that I knew more about his sexual fantasies than I knew about boyfriends. At the yogurt place that Saturday night, I smiled at Keisha and Luke, then turned around to face the counter. The line was long, and boyfriend took the hint and made small talk with me about yogurt flavors, as I tried to tune out Luke's voice while he excitedly discussed vacation plans with Keisha. He was trying to pin down dates, and Keisha was being cagey, and Luke asked if she'd rather go next month, and Keisha asked if they could talk about it later and change the subject. I cringed for both of them. After boyfriend and I got our yogurts, I led him to a far table by the exit and took a seat with my back to the rest of the crowded room so that Keisha and I could both have our space. A few minutes later, Luke stormed past our table and out the door, Keisha trailing behind him. Through the glass walls, we could see Keisha making apologetic gestures to Luke, and then Luke getting in his car and driving away, nearly running Keisha over. Boyfriend seemed to be putting it all together. "So that's how you know her." He joked that dating a therapist was like dating a CIA agent. I laughed and said that being a therapist sometimes felt more like having an affair with your entire caseload, past and present, simultaneously. We're always pretending not to know the people we know most intimately. But often, it's therapists who feel uncomfortable when our outside worlds collide. After all, we've seen our patients' real lives. They haven't seen ours. Outside of our offices, we're like Z-list celebrities, meaning that hardly anyone knows who we are. But for those few who do, a sighting is significant. Here are some things you can't do in public as a therapist. Cry to a friend in a restaurant. Argue with your spouse. Hit the building's elevator button relentlessly like it's a morphine pump. If you're in a rush on your way into the office, you can't honk at the slow car blocking the entrance to the parking garage in case your patient sees, or because the person you're honking at might be your patient. If you're a respected child psychologist, like a colleague of mine, you don't want to be standing in the bakery when your 4-year-old has a meltdown about not getting another cookie, culminating with the ear-piercing proclamation, "You're the worst mom ever," while your 6-year-old patient and her mother look on aghast. Nor, as happened to me, do you want to run into a former patient in the bra section of a department store as the salesperson announces loudly, "Good news, ma'am, I was able to find the miracle bra in the 34A. When you're making a restroom run between sessions, it's best to avoid the stall adjacent to your next patient, especially if either of you is taking a malodorous dump. And if you use the pharmacy across the street from your office, you don't want to be seen in the aisles buying condoms, tampons, constipation aids, adult diapers, creams for yeast infections and hemorrhoids, or prescriptions for STDs or mental disorders. One day, while feeling flu-like and weak, I went to the CVS across from my office to pick up a prescription. The pharmacist handed me what was supposed to be an antibiotic, but when I looked at the label, I saw it was an antidepressant. A few weeks earlier, a rheumatologist had prescribed the antidepressant off-label for fibromyalgia, which she thought might explain some lingering fatigue. But then we decided I should hold off due to its potential side effects. I never picked up that prescription, and the rheumatologist canceled it. Nevertheless, for some reason, it still sat in the computer. And every time I got a medication, the pharmacist would bring out the antidepressant and announce its name loudly while I prayed that none of my patients were in line behind me. Often when patients see our humanity, they leave us. Soon after John began seeing me, I ran into him at a Lakers game. It was halftime, and my son and I were waiting to buy a jersey. "Jesus Christ," I heard somebody mutter, and I followed the voice and spotted John ahead of us in the line next to ours. He was with another man and two girls who looked to be around John's older daughter's age, 10. A dad-daughter outing, I figured. John was complaining to his friend about the couple in front of them who were taking a while to make their purchase. They kept losing track of which sizes the cashier had said were sold out. "Oh, for God's sake," John said to the couple, his booming voice catching the attention of everyone around us. "They're out of the black Kobe in all sizes but the small, which is clearly not your size, and they only have the white Kobe in a kid size, which is also clearly not your size. But it is the size of these girls here who came to watch a Lakers game, which is starting up in..." Here he made a great show of holding up his watch. 4 minutes. "Chill, buddy," the guy and the couple said to John. "Chill," John said. "Maybe you're too chill. Maybe you should think about the fact that halftime is 15 minutes, and there's a sizable crowd behind you. Let's see, 20 people, 15 minutes, less than a minute per person. Oh shit, maybe I shouldn't be so chill." He flashed his gleaming smile at the guy, and that's when John noticed me looking at him. He froze, stunned to see his mistress hooker therapist standing there, the one whom he didn't want his wife or probably his friend or daughter to know about. We both looked away, ignoring each other. But after my son and I made our purchase, as we were running hand in hand back to our seats, I noticed John watching us from afar, an inscrutable expression on his face. Sometimes when I see people out in the world, particularly the first time it happens, I ask back in session what the experience was like for them. Some therapists wait for their patients to bring it up, but often not mentioning it makes it bigger, the elephant in the room, and acknowledging the encounter feels like a relief. So the following week in therapy, I asked John what it was like to see me at the Lakers game.
"What the fuck kind of question is that?" John said.
He let out a sigh, followed by a groan.
"Do you know how many people were at the game?"
"A lot," I said. "But sometimes it's strange seeing your therapist outside of the office, or seeing their children." I'd been thinking about the look on John's face as he watched me run off with Zach. I privately wondered what it was like for him to see a mother hand in hand with her son, given the loss of his own mother when he was a boy.
"You know what it was like seeing my therapist and her kid?" John asked.
"It was upsetting." I was surprised that John was willing to share his reaction. "How so?"
"Your son got the last Kobe jersey in my daughter's size."
"Oh?"
"Yeah, so that was upsetting."
I waited to see if he'd say more, if he'd stop with the jokes. We were both quiet for a bit. Then John began counting. 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3 Mississippi. He shot me an exasperated look.
"How long are we going to sit here saying nothing?"
I understood his frustration. In movies, therapist silences have become a cliche. But it's only in silence that people can truly hear themselves. Talking can keep people in their heads and safely away from their emotions. Being silent is like emptying the trash. When you stop tossing junk into the void, words, words, and more words, something important rises to the surface. And when the silence is a shared experience, it can be a goldmine for thoughts and feelings that the patient didn't even know existed. It's no wonder that I spent an entire session with Wendell saying virtually nothing and simply crying. Even great joy is sometimes best expressed through silence. As when a patient comes in after landing a hard-won promotion or getting engaged and can't find the words to express the magnitude of what she's feeling. So we sit in silence together, beaming. "I'm listening for whatever you have to say," I told John.
"Fine," he said. "In that case, I have a question for you."
"Hmm?"
"What was it like for you to see me?"
Nobody had ever asked me that before. I thought for a minute about my reaction and how I would convey it to John. I remembered my irritation with the way he was talking to that couple at the front of the line, and also my guilt at silently cheering him on. I, too, wanted to get back in the stadium before the second half started. I also remembered, when I was back at my seat,
glancing down and noticing that John and his group were sitting courtside. I saw his daughter showing him something on his phone, and as they were looking at it together, he put his arm around her, and they laughed and laughed, and I was so touched that I couldn't take my eyes off them. I wanted to share that with him. "Well," I began. "It was..."
"Oh, Jesus, I was kidding," John interrupted. "Obviously, I don't care what it was like for you. That's my point. It was a Lakers game. We were there to see the Lakers."
"Okay."
"Okay what?"
"Okay, you don't care."
"Damn right I don't."
I saw that look on John's face again. The one I noticed when he was watching me run with Zach. No matter how I tried to engage with John that day, by helping him to slow down and notice his feelings, by talking about his experience with me in the room, by sharing some of my experience in our conversation, he remained closed off. It wasn't until he was leaving that he turned back to me from the hallway and said, "Cute kid, by the way. Your son. The way he held your hand. Boys don't always do that." I waited for the punchline. Instead, he looked me right in the eye and said, almost pensively, "Enjoy it while it lasts." I stood there for a second. Enjoy it while it lasts. I wondered if he was thinking about his daughter. Maybe she'd outgrown letting John hold her hand in public. But he'd also said, "Boys don't always do that." What did he know about raising boys, being the father of two girls? It was about him and his mother, I decided. I tucked away the exchange for when he'd be ready to talk about her. Chapter 27. Wendell's mother. When Wendell was a boy, every August, he and his four siblings would pile into the family station wagon and drive with their parents from their Midwestern suburb to a cabin on a lake for a vacation with their large extended family. There were about 20 cousins in all, and the kids would wander as a pack, taking off in the morning, checking back in with the adults for lunch, which they ate ravenously while sitting on blankets spread over a verdant field, and disappearing again until dinner time. Sometimes the cousins would go for bike rides, but Wendell, the youngest, was afraid to ride a bike. Whenever his parents and older siblings offered to teach him, he feigned indifference. But everyone knew that the story of an older boy in town who had fallen off his bike, hit his head, and gone deaf from the blow had stuck in Wendell's mind. Fortunately, bikes didn't matter all that much at the cabin. Even when some of the cousins went out on their bikes, there were always enough kids with whom he could swim in the lake, climb trees, and play epic games of capture the flag. Then one summer, just after Wendell turned 13, he went missing. The clan of cousins had returned for lunch, and while they were munching on watermelon, somebody noticed that Wendell wasn't there. They checked inside the cabins, empty. Groups dispersed to search for him at the lake, in the woods, around town. But Wendell was nowhere to be found. After four terrifying hours for his family, Wendell returned, riding a bike. Apparently, a cute girl he'd met by the lake had asked him to go on a bike ride with her. So he went to the bike shop and explained his problem. The owner looked at this eager, skinny 13-year-old and instantly understood. He shut down the store, took Wendell to an abandoned lot, and taught him how to ride. Then he gave him a free day's rental. Now there he was, riding a bike toward the cabins. His parents cried in relief. Wendell and the girl from the lake rode together every day for the rest of the trip, and when it was over, they wrote letters back and forth for the next several months. But one day, Wendell got a letter from her saying that she was very sorry, but she had found a new boyfriend at her school and would no longer be writing to Wendell. His mom found the ripped page while emptying the trash. Wendell pretended not to care. "That year was a crash course in biking and love," Wendell's mother later remarked. "You take a risk, you fall down, and you get back up and do it all over again." Wendell did get back up, and in time he stopped pretending not to care. After graduating from college and joining the family business, he couldn't pretend any longer that his interest in psychology was just a hobby. So Wendell quit and got a doctorate in psychology instead. Now it was his father's turn to pretend not to care. And like Wendell, eventually his father got back up on that metaphorical bike and embraced his son's decision. At least, that's how Wendell's mother tells the story.
Of course, she didn't tell me this story. I know all of this courtesy of the internet. I wish I could say that I accidentally stumbled on this information. That I needed Wendell's address to send in a check and typed in his name and, oh wow, look what popped up. Right there on the very first page of results was an interview with his mother. But the only part that would be true is the part where I typed in his name. A small comfort. I wasn't alone in Googling my therapist. Julie once said something to me about a scientist at her university that I'd written about, as if we'd previously mentioned that we both knew him. We hadn't. Rita once alluded to the fact that she and I had both grown up in Los Angeles, though I'd never told her where I'd grown up. John finished one of his idiot rants about a just-out-of-college hire who'd graduated from Stanford. The Harvard of the West, my ass. Then, looking sheepishly at me, he added, I mean, no offense. He must have known I'd gone to Stanford. I also know that John Googled Wendell to check out his wife's therapist, because once he complained that Wendell had no website or photo, which immediately made John suspicious. What's the idiot trying to hide? He'd said. Oh, right, his incompetence. So patients do Google their therapists. But that wasn't my excuse. In fact, it had never occurred to me to Google Wendell, until he suggested that by Google-stalking boyfriend, I was holding on to a future that had been canceled. I was watching boyfriend's future unfold, while I stayed locked in the past. I'd need to accept that his future and mine, his present and mine, were now separate, and that all we had left in common was our history. Sitting at my laptop, I remembered the way Wendell had made this all so clear. Then I thought about how I knew nearly nothing about Wendell, other than the fact that he'd trained with Caroline, the colleague who gave me his name. I didn't know where he'd gotten his degree, or what he specialized in, or any of the basic information people tend to gather online before seeing a therapist. I'd been so eager for help that I took Caroline's referral from my friend, sight unseen. If something isn't working, do something different. Therapists are taught in training when they're hitting a wall with a patient, and we also suggest it to our patients. Why continue doing the same unhelpful thing over and over? If following boyfriend online was keeping me stuck, Wendell implied, I should do something different. But what? I tried closing my eyes and taking some breaths, an intervention that can disrupt a compulsive urge. And it worked. Sort of. When I opened my eyes, I didn't type boyfriend's name into Google. I typed in Wendell's. John had been right. Wendell was virtually invisible. No website, no LinkedIn, no Psychology Today listing or public Facebook or Twitter. Just a single link with his office address and phone number. For a practitioner of my generation, Wendell was unusually old school. I scanned the search results again. There were several Wendell Bronsons, but none was my therapist. I kept looking, and two pages in, I noticed a Yelp listing for Wendell. It had one review. I clicked. The reviewer, who went by the name Angela L., had been named an elite reviewer for 5 years in a row. And no wonder. She had posted about restaurants, dry cleaners, mattress warehouses, dog parks, dentists, a revolving door of them, gynecologists, manicurists, roofers, florists, clothing stores, hotels, pest control companies, movers, pharmacies, car dealers, tattoo parlors, a personal injury lawyer, and even a criminal defense attorney. Something about being falsely accused of a parking violation, which had somehow become a criminal offense. But most striking about Angela L. wasn't the sheer number of reviews. It was how aggressively negative nearly all of them were. Fail, she'd write, or dumbasses. Angela L. seemed to be horribly disappointed with everything. The way her cuticles were cut, the way a receptionist spoke to her. Even when she was on vacation, nothing escaped her scrutiny. She'd post reviews while at the rental car booth, at the hotel check-in, upon arrival in her room, in seemingly every place she ate and drank during her trip. And even out at the beach, where she'd once stepped on a rock in what was supposed to be silky white sand and claimed that it had injured her foot. Invariably, everyone she encountered was lazy or incompetent or stupid. She reminded me of John.
And then it occurred to me that maybe Angela L. was Margot.
Because the one person in the world that Angela L. didn't feel pissed off at or treated unfairly by was Wendell. He got Angela L.'s very first 5-star review. I've been to many therapists, no surprise there. But this time I feel like I'm making real strides, she wrote. She went on to gush about Wendell's compassion and wisdom, adding that he was helping her to see how her behaviors were contributing to her marital difficulties. Because of Wendell, she added, she had been able to reconcile with her husband after they'd separated. So, not Margot. The review had been posted a year ago. Scanning her subsequent entries, I noticed a trend. Gradually, her string of 1- and 2-star pans became 3- and then 4-star praise. Angela L. was becoming less angry at the world, less prone to blaming others for her unhappiness, what we call externalizing. There was less raging at customer service reps, fewer perceived slights, personalization, more self-awareness, acknowledging in one review that she could be difficult to please. The quantity of posts had dropped off too, making the endeavor seem less obsessive. She was approaching emotional sobriety, the ability to regulate one's feelings without self-medicating, whether that medication comes in the form of substances, defenses, affairs, or the internet. Kudos to Wendell, I thought. I could see Angela L.'s emotional evolution through the progression of her Yelp reviews. But just as I was admiring Wendell's skill, I came across another irate 1-star review from Angela L. It was for a shuttle service, a downgrade from an earlier 4-star review she'd given the company. Angela L. seemed livid that the bus played loud Muzak, and the driver couldn't turn it off. How could they attack riders like this? 3 paragraphs later, punctuated by multiple all caps and exclamation marks, Angela L. ended the review with, "I've used this company for months, but no more. Our relationship is over." Her dramatic breakup with the shuttle service, after all those more balanced reviews, might have been expected. Like many people, she'd probably backslid, regretted it, realized she'd hit bottom, and decided that moderation wasn't enough. She had to quit Yelp entirely. And so far, she had. That had been Angela L.'s final review, posted 6 months ago. But I wasn't ready to quit my Google stalking. 30 minutes later, my cursor hovered over the interview with Wendell's mother. The therapist I knew seemed both grounded and unconventional, tough and gentle, confident and awkward. Who had raised him? I felt like I'd found the mother load, so to speak. Of course, I clicked. The Q&A, which turned out to be a 10-page family history, appeared on the blog of a local organization that was documenting the lives of notable families who had lived in that Midwestern town for 50 years. Both of Wendell's parents, I learned, had grown up poor. His maternal grandmother died in childbirth, so his mom went to live with her father's sister in a small apartment, and their family became hers. Wendell's father, meanwhile, had become a self-made man, the first in his family to go to college. It was at this large state university that he met Wendell's mother, the first woman in her family to get a college degree. After they married, he started a business, she gave birth to a brood of 5, and by the time Wendell was a teenager, the family had become spectacularly wealthy. One of the reasons for the interview I was reading. Apparently, Wendell's parents gave away much of their wealth to charitable causes. By the time I got to the names of Wendell's siblings and their spouses and children, I had become as unhinged as Angela L. I researched Wendell's entire family, what they did for a living, what cities they were in, how old their kids were, who was divorced. None of this was easy to find. My mission involved extensive cross-referencing and hours of time. Admittedly, I knew a few things about Wendell from comments he'd strategically dropped into our sessions. Once, after I said, "But it's not fair," about the boyfriend situation, Wendell looked at me and replied, kindly, "You sound like my 10-year-old. What makes you think life is supposed to be fair?" I took in his point, but I also thought, oh, he has a kid around my son's age. When he tossed me these morsels, they felt like unexpected gifts.
But that night on the internet, there was always another lead, another link. He'd met his wife through a mutual friend. His family lived in a Spanish-style house that, according to Zillow, had doubled in value since they'd bought it. Recently, when he'd needed to reschedule our appointment, it was because he was presenting at a conference. By the time I finally shut down my laptop, the night was over, and I felt guilty, empty, and exhausted. The internet can be both a salve and an addiction. A way to block out pain, the salve, while simultaneously creating it, the addiction. When the cyber drug wears off, you feel worse, not better. Patients think they want to know about their therapists, but often once they find out, they wish they hadn't, because this knowledge has the potential to contaminate the relationship, leaving patients to edit, consciously or not, what they say in their sessions. I knew that what I'd done had been destructive, and I also knew that I wouldn't tell Wendell about it. I understood why, when a patient inadvertently reveals knowing more about me than I've shared, and I ask about it. There's a slight hesitation while the person decides whether to be honest or lie. It's hard to confess to stalking your therapist. I was ashamed of invading Wendell's privacy, of wasting away the evening, and I vowed, perhaps like Angela L., never to do it again. Still, the damage had been done. When I went back to Wendell the following Wednesday, I felt weighed down by my newfound knowledge. I couldn't help thinking that it was only a matter of time before I'd slip up, just like my own patients did. Chapter 28. Addicted. Chart note. Charlotte. Patient. Age 25. Reports feeling anxious for the past few months, though nothing of note has recently occurred. States that she is bored at her job. Describes difficulty with parents and a busy social life, but no history of significant romantic relationships. Reports that to relax, she drinks a couple glasses of wine nightly. "You're going to kill me," Charlotte says, as she saunters in and slowly settles herself into the oversized chair diagonally to my right, arranges a pillow on her lap, then tosses the throw blanket over it. She has never sat on the couch, not even at the first session, instead making the chair her throne. As usual, she takes her belongings out of her bag, one by one, unpacking for her 50-minute stay. On the left arm of the chair, she places her phone and pedometer. On the right, her water bottle and sunglasses. Today, she's wearing blush and lipstick, and I know what that means. She's been flirting again with the guy in the waiting room. Our suite has a large reception area where patients wait to be seen. Leaving their appointments is more private. There's an exit through an interior corridor that leads to the building's hallway. Patients generally keep to themselves in the waiting room, but Charlotte has something going on. The dude, as Charlotte calls the object of her flirtation, neither of us knows his name, is my colleague Mike's patient, and he and Charlotte have their sessions at the same time. According to Charlotte, the first time the dude showed up, they noticed each other immediately, stealing glances over their respective phones. This went on for weeks, and after their sessions, which also ended at the same time, they'd exit through the interior door, only to steal more glances at each other in the elevator before going their separate ways. Finally, one day Charlotte came in with news. "The dude just talked to me," she whispered, as if the dude could hear her through the walls. "What did he say?" I asked. "He said, so what's your issue?" Great line, I thought, impressed despite its cheesiness. "So here's the part where you're going to kill me," she said that day. She took a big breath, but I'd heard this refrain before. If Charlotte drank too much the previous week, she'd open the session with, "You're going to kill me." If she'd hooked up with a guy and regretted it, as happened often, she'd open with, "You're going to kill me." I was even going to kill her when she put off researching graduate school options and missed the application deadlines. We'd talked before about how underneath the projection was a deep sense of shame. "Okay, you don't want to kill me," she conceded. "But ugh, I didn't know what to say, so I froze. I completely ignored him and pretended to text. God, I hate myself." I imagined the dude at that very moment sitting in my colleague's therapy room, just a few doors away, and recounting the same incident. "I finally spoke to that girl in the waiting room, and she completely rejected me.
Ugh, I sounded like an idiot. God, I hate myself.
Still, the next week, the flirtation continued. When the dude walked into the waiting room, Charlotte told me she opened with a line she'd been rehearsing all week. You want to know what my issue is? Charlotte asked him. I freeze when strangers in waiting rooms ask me questions. That made the dude laugh, and they were both laughing when I opened the door to greet Charlotte. Upon seeing me, the dude blushed. Guilty? I wondered. As we walked toward my office, Charlotte and I passed Mike, who was approaching to collect the dude. Mike and I met each other's eyes, then immediately looked away. Yep, I thought. The dude has told him about Charlotte, too. By the following week, the waiting room banter was in full swing. Charlotte told me that she asked the dude his name, and he replied, I can't tell you. Why not? She asked. Everything in here is confidential, he said. Okay, confidential, she shot back. My name's Charlotte. I'm going to talk about you with my therapist now.
Hope you get your money's worth, he said with a sexy grin.
I'd seen the dude a few times, and Charlotte was right. He had a killer smile. And while I didn't know the first thing about him, something in me sensed danger for Charlotte. Given her history with men, I had a feeling the whole thing would end badly. And 2 weeks later, Charlotte walked in with an update. The dude had come to a session with a woman. Of course, I thought, unavailable. Just Charlotte's type. Charlotte, in fact, had used that same expression every time she mentioned the dude. He's so my type. What most people mean by type is a sense of attraction. A type of physical appearance or a type of personality turns them on. But what underlies a person's type, in fact, is a sense of familiarity. It's no coincidence that people who had angry parents often end up choosing angry partners, that those with alcoholic parents are frequently drawn to partners who drink quite a bit, or that those who had withdrawn or critical parents find themselves married to spouses who are withdrawn or critical. Why would people do this to themselves? Because the pull toward that feeling of home makes what they want as adults hard to disentangle from what they experienced as children. They have an uncanny attraction to people who share the characteristics of a parent who, in some way, hurt them. In the beginning of a relationship, these characteristics will be barely perceptible. But the unconscious has a finely tuned radar system inaccessible to the conscious mind. It's not that people want to get hurt again. It's that they want to master a situation in which they felt helpless as children. Freud called this repetition compulsion. Maybe this time, the unconscious imagines, I can go back and heal that wound from long ago by engaging with somebody familiar, but new. The only problem is, by choosing familiar partners, people guarantee the opposite result. They reopen the wounds and feel even more inadequate and unlovable. This happens completely outside of awareness. Charlotte, for instance, said that she wanted a reliable boyfriend capable of intimacy. But every time she met somebody who was her type, chaos and frustration ensued. Conversely, after a recent date with a guy who seemed to possess many of the qualities she said she wanted in a partner, she came to therapy and reported, "It's too bad, but there just wasn't any chemistry." To her unconscious, his emotional stability felt too foreign. The therapist Terry Real described our well-worn behaviors as our internalized family of origin. It's our repertoire of relational themes. People don't have to tell you their stories with words because they always act them out for you. Often they project negative expectations onto the therapist, but if the therapist doesn't meet those negative expectations, this corrective emotional experience with a reliable and benevolent person changes the patients. The world, they learn, turns out not to be their family of origin. If Charlotte works through her complicated feelings toward her parents with me, she'll find herself increasingly attracted to a different type, one that might give her the unfamiliar experience she's seeking with a compassionate, reliable, and mature partner. Until then, every time she meets an available guy who might love her back, her unconscious rejects his stability as not interesting. She still equates feeling loved not with peace or joy, but with anxiety. And so it goes. Same guy, different name, same outcome. Did you see her? Charlotte asked,
referring to the woman who came to therapy with the dude. She must be his girlfriend. In the quick peek I'd gotten of the two of them, they were sitting in adjoining chairs, but not interacting in any way. Like the dude, the young woman was tall with thick, dark hair. She could be his sister, I thought, coming with him for family therapy. But Charlotte was probably right. More likely, she was the girlfriend. And now, in today's session, 2 months after the dude's girlfriend became a fixture in the waiting room, Charlotte has pronounced again that I'm going to kill her. I run through the possibilities in my mind, the first of which is that she slept with the dude, despite the girlfriend. I imagine the girlfriend and the dude sitting in the waiting room with Charlotte, the girlfriend unaware that Charlotte has slept with her boyfriend. I imagine the girlfriend gradually getting wise to this and dumping the dude, leaving Charlotte and the dude free to become a couple. Then I imagine Charlotte doing what she does in relationships, avoiding intimacy, and the dude doing whatever he does in relationships, only Mike knows, and the whole thing blowing up in a spectacular fashion. But I'm wrong. Today, Charlotte believes that I'm going to kill her, because as she was leaving her finance job last night to head out for her very first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, some coworkers invited her to join them for drinks, and she said yes, because she thought it would be a good networking opportunity. Then she tells me, without a trace of irony, that she drank too much because she was upset with herself for not going to the AA meeting. God, she says, I hate myself. I was once told by a supervisor that every therapist has the experience of seeing a patient with whom the similarities are so striking that this person feels like your doppelganger. When Charlotte walked into my office, I knew she was that patient. Almost. She was the twin of my 20-year-old self. It wasn't just that we looked alike and had similar reading habits, mannerisms, and default ways of thinking, over and negative. Charlotte came to me 3 years after she had graduated from college, and while everything looked good on the outside, she had friends and a respectable job, she paid her own bills, she was also unsure of her career direction, conflicted about her parents, and generally lost. Granted, I didn't drink too much or sleep with random people, but I'd moved through that decade just as blindly. It may seem logical that if you identify with a patient, it will make the work easier because you intuitively understand her. But in many ways, this kind of identification makes things harder. I've had to be extra vigilant in our sessions, making sure that I'm seeing Charlotte as a separate person and not as a younger version of myself that I can go back and fix. More so than with other patients, I've had to resist the temptation to jump in and set her straight too quickly when she plops down in her chair, tells a meandering anecdote, and finishes with a demand couched in a question. Isn't my manager unreasonable? Can you believe my roommate said that? At 25, though, Charlotte has pain but not significant regret. Unlike me, she hasn't had a midlife reckoning. Unlike Rita, she hasn't damaged her children or married someone abusive. She has the gift of time, if she uses it wisely. Charlotte didn't think she had an addiction when she first entered treatment for depression and anxiety. She drank, she insisted, only a couple of glasses of wine each night, to relax. I immediately applied the standard therapeutic calculation used when somebody seems defensive about drug or alcohol use. Whatever the total reported, double it. Eventually, I learned that Charlotte's nightly alcohol consumption averaged 3/4 of a bottle of wine, sometimes preceded by a cocktail, or two. She said that she never drank during the day, except on weekends, she added, because hashtag brunch, and rarely appeared drunk to others, having developed a tolerance over the years. But she did sometimes have trouble recalling events and details the day after drinking. Still, she believed there was nothing unusual about her social drinking, and she obsessed about her real addiction, the one that increasingly plagued her the longer she stayed in therapy. Me. If she could, she said, she'd come to therapy every day. Each week after I'd indicate that our time was up, Charlotte would sigh dramatically and exclaim with surprise, "Really? Are you serious?" Then very slowly, while I stood at the open door, she'd gather her scattered belongings one by one. Sunglasses, cell phone, water bottle, hairband, frequently leaving behind something that she'd have to come back for later. See, she'd say when I'd suggest that her leaving items behind was her way of not leaving her session. I'm addicted to therapy. She'd use the generic term therapy, rather than the more personal, you. But as much as she disliked leaving, therapy was the perfect setup for somebody like Charlotte, a person who craved connection, but also avoided it. Our relationship was the ideal combination of intimacy and distance. She could get close to me, but not too close, because at the end of the hour, whether she liked it or not, she went home. During the week, too, she could get close, but not too close, emailing me articles she read or one-liners about something that had happened between sessions. My mom called and acted crazy, and I didn't yell at her. Or photos of various things she found amusing. A license plate that read, "For Ev Jung." Not taken, I hoped, while she was inebriated behind the wheel. If I tried to talk about these things during our sessions, Charlotte would brush them off. "Oh, I just thought it was funny," she said about the license plate. When she sent an article on an epidemic of loneliness among her age group, I asked about its resonance for her. "Nothing, really," she replied with a perplexed look on her face. "I just thought it was culturally interesting." Of course, patients think about their therapists between sessions all the time. But for Charlotte, keeping me in mind felt less like a stable connection and more like a loss of control. What if she relied on me too much? To deal with that fear, she'd already left our therapy and returned twice, always struggling to stay away from what she called her fix. Each time, she quit without notice. The first time, she announced in session that she needed to quit, and the only way I'll do it is if I leave quickly. Then she literally got up and bolted from the room. I'd known something was up when she hadn't unpacked the contents of her bag onto the armrests and left the blanket draped over the chair. 2 months later, she asked if she could come back, for one session, to discuss an issue with her cousin. But when she arrived, it was apparent that her depression had returned. So she stayed for 3 months. Just as she started feeling better and began to make some positive changes, an hour before her session, she sent me an email explaining that once and for all, she needed to quit. Therapy, that is. The drinking continued. Then one night, Charlotte was driving home from a birthday party and crashed into a pole. She called me the next morning, after the police had issued her a DUI. "I didn't see it at all," she told me after she arrived wearing a cast. "And I don't just mean the pole." Her car had been totaled, but miraculously, she'd ended up with just a broken arm. "Maybe," she said for the first time. "I have a drinking problem, not a therapist problem." But she was still drinking a year later when she met the dude. Chapter 29. The Rapist. At John's appointment time, my green light goes on. I walk down the hall to the waiting room, but when I open the door, the chair John usually takes is empty, save for a bag of takeout. For a minute, I think he might be in the restroom down the hall, but the public key is still hanging on the hook. I wonder if John's running late. After all, presumably he ordered the food, or if he's decided not to come today because of what happened last week. That session had started off uneventfully. As usual, the delivery guy brought our Chinese chicken salads, and after John complained about the dressing, too saturated, and the chopsticks, too flimsy, he got right down to business. "I was thinking," John began, "about the word therapist." He took a bite of his salad. "You know, if you break it in two." I knew where this was going. Therapist is spelled the same way as the rapist. It's a common joke in the therapy world. I smiled. "I wonder if you're trying to tell me that sometimes it's hard to be here. I've certainly felt that with Wendell, especially when his eyes seem to bore into me and there's no place to hide. By day, therapists hear people's secrets and fantasies, their shame and their failures, invading the spaces they normally keep private. Then boom, the hour's over, just like that. Are we emotional rapists?" "Hard to be here," John said. "Nah, you can be a pain in the ass, but this isn't the worst place to be." "So you think I'm a pain in the ass?" It took some effort not to emphasize the I, as in, "So you think I'm a pain in the ass?" "Of course," John said. You ask too many damn questions.
Oh? Like what?
Like that.
I nodded. I can see how that might annoy you.
John brightened. You can?
I can. I think you'd rather keep me at a distance when I'm trying to get to know you.
And here we go again.
John rolled his eyes dramatically. At least once a session. I bring up our pattern. My trying to connect with him, his trying to flee. He may be resistant to acknowledging it now, but I welcome his resistance, because resistance is a clue to where the crux of the work lies. It signals what a therapist needs to pay attention to. During training, whenever we interns felt frustrated by resistant patients, our supervisors would counsel, "Resistance is a therapist's friend. Don't fight it. Follow it." In other words, try to figure out why it's there in the first place. Meanwhile, I was interested in the second part of what John had said. "Just to be more annoying," I continued, "I'm going to ask you another question. You said this isn't the worst place to be. What's the worst?"
"You don't know?"
I shrugged. "No."
John's eyes bugged out. "Really?"
I nodded.
"Oh, come on, you know," he said. "Just guess."
I didn't want to get into a power struggle with John, so I took a guess. "At work, when you don't feel that people understand you? At home with Margot, when you feel you're disappointing her?"
John made the sound of a game show buzzer.
"Wrong." He took a bite of salad, swallowed, then lifted his chopsticks into the air to punctuate his words.
"I came here, you may or may not remember, because I was having trouble sleeping."
I noticed his dig.
"May not."
"I remember," I said. He let out a huge sigh, as if summoning the patience of Gandhi.
"So, Sherlock, if sleeping is a problem for me, where do you think it's hard for me to be right now?"
"Here," I wanted to say. "You're having trouble being here. But in good time, we'll talk about that."
"Bed," I said.
"Bingo!" I waited for him to elaborate, but he went back to his salad. We sat together while he ate and swore at his chopsticks.
"Aren't you going to say anything?"
"I'd like to hear more," I said. "What are you thinking about as you're trying to fall asleep?"
"Jesus Christ, is something wrong with your memory today? What do you think I'm thinking about? Everything I come in here telling you each week. Work, my kids, Margot."
John went on to relate an argument he'd had with Margot the night before, about whether their older daughter should get a cell phone for her 11th birthday. Margot wanted her to have it for safety, now that Grace was going to be walking home from school with her friends, and John thought that Margot was being overprotective.
"It's two blocks," John said he told Margot. "Besides, if someone tries to kidnap her, it's not like Grace is going to say, 'Hey, excuse me, Mr. Kidnapper, let me just pause here for a second, get my phone out of my backpack and call my mom.' And unless the kidnapper is a complete idiot, which he could be, okay, but he's probably just a sick motherfucker, the first thing he's going to do if he steals someone's kid is look in her backpack for a cell phone and dump it or destroy it so we can't track her location. So what's the point of the phone?"
John's face had turned red. He was really worked up. Since our Skype call the day after Margot had insinuated that she might leave, things between them had calmed down. As John described it, he tried to listen more. He tried to get home from work earlier. But really, it seemed to me that he was, as he said, appeasing her. Whereas what she likely wanted was the very thing John and I struggled with together, his presence. John packed the remnants of his lunch into the takeout bag and tossed it across the room, where it landed with a thud in the trash can.
"And that's why I couldn't sleep," he went on. "Because an 11-year-old doesn't need a cell phone. And you know what? She'll get one anyway, because if I put my foot down, Margot will sulk and tell me in some passive-aggressive way that she wants to leave again. And you know why that is? Because of her idiot therapist."
Wendell. I tried to imagine Wendell hearing Margot's version of this story. "We were talking about getting Grace a cell phone for her birthday, and John just went ballistic." I pictured Wendell in position C, wearing his khakis and cardigan, giving Margot the head-tilted look. I imagined him asking a Buddha-like question about whether she might be curious why John had had such a strong reaction. I figured that by the time their session was over, Margot would have a slightly different take on John's motives, just as I had come to see boyfriend's actions as less than sociopathic.
And you know what else she's going to tell her idiot therapist? John continued. She's going to tell him that her fucking husband can't fucking have sex with her because when I got in bed at the same time she did, instead of finishing up my emails, another thing I'm doing to make her happy, by the way, I was so pissed off that I wouldn't have sex with her. She approached me, but I told her I was tired and didn't feel well, like a housewife in the 50s with a headache. Jesus Christ, right?
Sometimes our emotional states can really affect our bodies, I said, trying to normalize this for John.
Can we keep my penis out of this? That's not the point of the story.
Sex comes up with almost every patient I see, the same way that love does. Earlier on, I'd asked John about his sex life with Margot, given the difficulties in their relationship. It's a common belief that people's sex lives reflect their relationships, that a good relationship equals a good sex life and vice versa. But that's only true sometimes. Just as often, there are people who have extremely problematic relationships and fantastic sex, and there are people who are deeply in love but who don't click with the same intensity in the bedroom. John had told me that their sex life was okay. When I'd asked what okay meant, he said that he was attracted to Margot and enjoyed sex with her, but that they went to bed at different times, so it was less frequent than in the past. But often he contradicted himself. At one point, he said that he tended to initiate sex, but Margot didn't want it. Another time, he said that she often initiated, but only if I do what she wants during the day. Once, he said that they talked about their sexual desires and needs. Another time, he said, "We've been having sex with each other for over a decade. What's there to talk about? We know what the other person wants." Now I get the sense that John was having trouble getting an erection, and that he felt humiliated.
The point of the story, John went on, is that there's a double standard in our house. If Margot's too tired to have sex one night, I let it go. I don't corner her with a toothbrush in her mouth the next morning and say, here he did the Oprah impression again. "I'm sorry you weren't feeling well last night. Maybe we can find some time to connect tonight."
John looked up at the ceiling and shook his head.
Men don't talk like that. They don't dissect every little thing and think it has meaning.
He made air quotes when he said the word meaning. It feels like picking a scab instead of letting it be.
Exactly, John nodded. And now I'm the bad guy, unless she gets to make all the decisions. If I have an opinion, I'm not seeing, more air quotes, what Margot's needs are. So then Grace gets into this and says that I'm being unreasonable, that everyone has a phone, and that it's 2-1, girls win. She actually said that, girls win.
He lowered his arms now that he was done with the air quotes.
And that's when I realized that part of what's driving me nuts and making it hard to sleep is that there's too much estrogen in the house and nobody understands my perspective.
Ruby's starting elementary school next year, but already acts like her older sister. And Gabe's getting so emotional, like a teenager. I'm outnumbered in my own home, and everyone wants something from me every minute, and nobody understands that I might need something too, like peace and quiet, and some say in what goes on.
Gabe?
John sat up.
What?
You said Gabe was getting so emotional. Did you mean Grace? I did a quick memory check. His 4-year-old's name was Ruby, and his older daughter was Grace. Didn't he just say Grace wanted a phone for her birthday? Or did I have that wrong? Was it Gabriella? Gabby shortened to Gabe? The way some girls named Charlotte are called Charlie nowadays? I'd once confused Ruby with Rosie, their dog, but I was pretty sure I had Grace's name right.
I did?
He seemed flustered, but recovered quickly.
Well, I meant Grace. Obviously, I'm sleep deprived, like I told you.
But you know a Gabe? Something about John's reaction made me suspect that this wasn't just about insomnia. I wondered if Gabe was somebody significant in his life. One of his brothers, a childhood friend, the name of his father.
This is an idiotic conversation, John said, looking away. I meant Grace. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, Dr. Freud.
We both sat there. Who's Gabe? I asked gently. John was quiet for a long while. His face went through a series of expressions in rapid succession, like a time-lapse video of a storm. This was new. he generally had two modes, angry and jokey. Eventually, he looked at his shoes, the same checkered sneakers I'd seen on our Skype call, and shifted into the safest gear, neutral. "Gabe is my son," John said so quietly that I could barely hear him. "How's that for a twist in the case, Sherlock?" Then he grabbed his phone, walked out the door, and shut it behind him. Now here I am, a week later, standing in the empty waiting room. And I'm not sure what to make of the fact that our lunches have arrived, but John hasn't. I haven't heard from him since the revelation, but I've been thinking about him. "Gabe is my son," rang through my mind at the most random of moments, especially at bedtime. This felt like a classic example of projective identification. In projection, a patient attributes his beliefs to another person. In projective identification, he sends them into another person. For instance, a man may feel angry at his boss at work, then come home and say to his spouse, "You seem angry." He's projecting, because the spouse isn't angry. In projective identification, on the other hand, the man may feel angry at his boss, return home, and essentially insert his anger into his partner, actually making the partner feel angry. Projective identification is like tossing a hot potato to the other person. The man no longer has to feel his anger, since it's now living inside his partner. I talked about John's session in my Friday consultation group. Just as he had been lying in bed with a metaphorical circus in his mind, I told the group that now I'd been doing the same thing, and since I was holding all of his anxiety, he was probably sleeping like a baby. Meanwhile, my mind reeled. What to do with this bomb that John had detonated before walking out the door? John has a son? From his youth? Is he living a double life? Does Margot know? I flashed back to our session after the Lakers game, when he'd commented on the hand-holding with my son. "Enjoy it while it lasts." What John did, the walking out part at least, isn't uncommon, especially in couples therapy. Patients occasionally walk out if they feel besieged by intense feelings. Sometimes that person benefits from a phone call from the therapist, particularly if the reason he or she bolted had to do with feeling misunderstood or injured. Often, though, it's best to let patients sit with their feelings, get their bearings, and then work through it with them the following session. My consultation group believed that if John was already feeling cornered by the people around him, a call from me might be too much. Everyone agreed. Back off. Don't push him. Wait for him to come back. Except, today he's not here. I picked up the unmarked takeout bag in the waiting room and looked to make sure it's ours. Inside are two Chinese chicken salads and John's soda. Did he forget to cancel the order? Or is he using the food to communicate with me, making his absence known? Sometimes when people don't show, they do it to punish the therapist and send a message. "You've upset me." And sometimes they do it to avoid not just the therapist, but themselves. To avoid confronting their shame or pain or the truth they know they need to tell. People communicate through their attendance. Whether they're prompt or late, cancel an hour beforehand, or don't show up at all. I walk back into our suite, place the food bag in the fridge, and decide to use the hour to catch up on chart notes. When I get to my desk, I notice that I have some voicemails. The first is from John. "Hi, it's me," his message begins. "Shit, I completely forgot to cancel until my phone beeped just now with our, appointment. Usually my assistant schedules everything, but since I do the shrink thing myself. Anyway, I can't make it today. Work is insane and I can't get away. Sorry about that." My initial thought is that John needs some space, and we'll be back next week. I imagine that he wrestled up to the last minute with whether or not to come today, and that's why he didn't call in advance, and also why the standing food order appeared here without him. But then I play my next message. "Hi, it's me again. So, I didn't forget to call, actually." There's a long pause. So long that I think John may have hung up. I'm about to hit delete, when finally he continues. "I was going to tell you that, I'm not going to do therapy anymore. But don't worry, it's not because you're an idiot.
I realized that if I'm not sleeping, I should get sleep medication. Obviously. So I did, and problem solved. Better living through chemistry, haha. And, as for the other stuff we talked about, you know, all the stress I'm under, I guess that's just life, and if I get some sleep, I'll be less annoyed by it all. Idiots will always be idiots, and there's no pill for that, right? We'd have to medicate half the city if there were. He laughs at his joke. The same laugh I remember from when he said I'd be like his mistress. His laugh is his shelter. Anyway, he goes on. Sorry for the late notice. And I know I owe you for today. Don't worry, I'm good for it. He laughs again, then hangs up. I stare at the phone. That's it? No thank you or even a goodbye at the end? Just done? I had expected that something like this might happen after the first few sessions. But now that I've been seeing him for nearly 6 months, I'm surprised by his sudden departure. In his own way, John seemed to be forming an attachment to me. Or maybe it's that I've been forming an attachment to him. I've come to feel real affection for John, to see flashes of humanity behind his obnoxious facade. I think about John and his son Gabe, some boy or grown man who may or may not know his father. I wonder if on some level, John wants to leave me with the burden of this mystery, a big fuck you for not helping him feel better quickly enough. Take that, Sherlock, you idiot. I want to let John know that I'm here, to somehow communicate that he, and I, can handle whatever he brings to therapy. I want him to know it's safe to talk about Gabe here, however tricky that situation or relationship might be. At the same time, I want to respect where he is right now. I don't want to be the rapist. It would be so much better to say all of this in person, though. In my informed consent paperwork that I give to patients before they start treatment, I recommend that they participate in at least 2 termination sessions. I discuss this with new patients at the outset, so that if something upsets them during treatment, they don't act impulsively to rid themselves of the uncomfortable feelings. Even if they do feel it's best to stop, at least the decision will have been reflected upon, so they can leave feeling that they made a thoughtful and considered choice. As I pull out some patient charts, I remember something John said while making the slip about Gabe. There's too much estrogen in the house, and nobody understands my perspective. I'm outnumbered. Everyone wants something from me. Nobody understands that I might need something too, like peace and quiet, and some say in what goes on. Now it makes sense. Gabe could counteract some of the estrogen. Maybe John believes that Gabe understands him, or would, if he were in John's life. I put down my pen and dial John's number. When his voicemail beeps, I say, "Hi, John, it's Lori. I got your message, and thanks for letting me know. I just put our lunches in the fridge, and I thought of last week when you said that nobody understands that you might need something, too. I think you're right, that you need something. But I'm not so sure that nobody understands this. Everyone needs something, often lots of things. I'd like to hear what it is that you need. You mentioned needing peace and quiet, and maybe finding peace and quieting down the noise in your head will involve Gabe, and maybe it won't. But we don't have to talk about Gabe if you don't want to. I'm here if you change your mind and decide you want to come in next week to continue our conversation, even if it's just one last time. My door is open to you. Bye for now." I make a note in John's chart and then close it. But as I lean over the file cabinet, I decide not to move it into the terminated patient section today. I remember in medical school how hard it was for us students to accept that somebody had died and that there was nothing else we could do, to have to be the person to call it, to say aloud those dreaded words, time of death. I look at the clock. 3:17. Let's give it one more week, I think. I'm not ready to call it just yet. Chapter 30. On the clock. In my final year of graduate school, I was required to do a clinical traineeship.
The traineeship is like a baby version of the 3,000-hour internship that comes later and is required for licensure. By this point, I'd taken the necessary coursework, participated in classroom role-play simulations, and watched countless hours of videotape of renowned therapists conducting sessions. I'd also sat behind a one-way mirror and observed our most skilled professors in real-time therapy sessions. Now, it was time to get in a room with my own patients. Like most trainees in the field, I'd be doing this under supervision at a community clinic, much the way medical interns get their training in teaching hospitals. On my first day, immediately after the orientation, my supervisor hands me a stack of charts and explains that the one on top will be my first case. The chart contains only basic information: name, birth date, address, phone number. The patient, Michelle, who is 30 and has listed her boyfriend as her emergency contact, will be arriving in an hour. If it seems strange that this clinic is letting me, a person who has performed exactly 0 hours of therapy, take on somebody's treatment, it's simply the way therapists are trained: by doing. Medical school was also a trial by fire. In medicine, students learn procedures by the see one, do one, teach one method. In other words, you watched a physician, say, palpate an abdomen. You palpated the next abdomen yourself. And then you taught another student how to palpate an abdomen. Presto, you're deemed competent to palpate abdomens. Therapy, though, felt different to me. I found performing a concrete task with specific steps, like palpating an abdomen or starting an IV, less nerve-wracking than figuring out how to apply the numerous abstract psychological theories I'd studied over the past several years to the hundreds of possible scenarios that any one therapy patient might present. Still, as I make my way to the waiting room to meet Michelle, I'm not terribly worried. This initial 50-minute session is an intake, which means I'll gather a history and establish some rapport with her. All I have to do is collect information using a specific set of questions as my guide, then I'll bring those results to my supervisor so that we can formulate a treatment plan. I spent years as a journalist asking probing questions and establishing a comfort level with people I didn't know. How hard, I think, can this be? Michelle is tall and too thin. Her clothes are rumpled, her hair unkempt, her skin pasty. Once we're seated, I open by asking what brings her here, and she tells me that recently she has had trouble doing anything but cry. Then, as if on cue, she starts crying. And by crying, I mean howling, in the way one might if just informed that the person she loves most in the world has just died. There's no warm-up, no wetness in her eyes that leads to a light drizzle and gradually a downpour. This is a level 4 tsunami. Her entire body shakes. Mucus drips from her nose. Wheezy noises emanate from her throat. And frankly, I'm not sure how she can breathe. We're 30 seconds in. This isn't how the simulated intakes went at school. Unless you've sat alone in a quiet room with a sobbing stranger, you don't really know how simultaneously awkward and intimate it feels. To make matters weirder, I have no context for this outburst, because I haven't gotten to the history part yet. I know nothing about this very distressed person sitting 5 feet away from me. I'm not sure what to do or even where to look. If I look right at her, will she feel self-conscious? If I look away, will she feel ignored? Should I say something to engage with her, or wait for her to finish crying? I'm so uncomfortable that I worry a nervous giggle might erupt. I try to stay focused, thinking about my list of questions, and I know I should be asking how long she's felt this way. History of present condition. How severe it's been. Whether something happened that brought this on. A precipitating event. But I do nothing. I wish that my supervisor were in the room with me right now. I feel totally useless. The tsunami continues with no sign of letting up. I consider waiting it out, figuring she'll run out of steam soon, and then be ready to talk, the way my son would as a toddler after throwing a tantrum. But it just keeps going and going. Finally, I decide to say something. But as the words leave my lips, I'm convinced I've just uttered the dumbest thing that any therapist has ever said in the history of the field. I say, "Yeah, you seem depressed, all right." I feel bad for this woman the instant I say it,
Like, I should punctuate it with a big, duh. This poor, depressed 30-year-old is in tremendous pain, and she isn't coming here so that a trainee on her first day can state the blatantly obvious. As I try to think how to correct my error, I wonder if she'll request a different therapist. I'm sure she isn't going to want somebody like me in charge of her care. But instead, Michelle stops crying. As quickly as she started, she wipes the tears away with a tissue and takes a long, deep breath. And then she half smiles. Yeah, she says. I am so fucking depressed. She seems almost giddy to be saying this aloud. It's the first time, she tells me, that somebody has said the word depressed about her condition. She goes on to explain that she's an architect who's had some success, having been part of a team that designed a few high-profile buildings. She's always been melancholy, she says, but nobody really knows the extent of it because she's generally social and busy. About a year ago, though, she noticed a change. Her energy level decreased, as did her appetite. Just getting out of bed each morning felt like a huge effort. She wasn't sleeping well. She fell out of love with her live-in boyfriend, but wasn't sure if it was because she was so down or because he wasn't the right person for her. In the past few months, she's been secretly crying every night in the bathroom while her boyfriend sleeps, making sure not to wake him. She's never cried in front of anybody the way she has just cried in front of me. She cries some more, and through her tears she says, "This is like emotional yoga." What has brought her here now, she confides, is that her work has started getting sloppy, and her boss noticed. She can't concentrate because trying not to cry is taking all of her focus. She looked up the symptoms of depression and ticked off all the boxes. She's never been in therapy before, but knows she needs help.